All right, 5 p.m. on Wednesday. 90.3 WHPC, the voice of Nassau Community College. Time for American Hit Radio. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, my lovely wife, co-host, and engineer extraordinaire, Heidi Morales Ryan.
Getting it started.
Yeah, getting ready to bring
Don't
you
Don't get me started.
Another, we're going to wind you up. Full hour of music, of course, as usual today, between 5 and 6. We do this every Wednesday and Friday. The Wednesday portion of our show, we've been working our way through two consecutive lists, running them at the same time in chronological order. One of them is the top 500 of the top 40. The other one we are calling the alternative top 40. Going through them both simultaneously, like I said, in chronological order. 500 albums in each list. It's a total of 1,000 to cover. It seems like we are about maybe 15% of our way into this, which is to say we've been doing this for about 3 years already. And we still have 85% of it left to go. It's all right. We started in 1964, and we are already all the way up to 1970, the month of April, to be precise. And we have a number one album to cover. So this is yet another album, the 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth in a row that is from the top 500 of the top 40. Not too surprising, really, because there weren't a whole heck of a lot of underground albums, quote unquote, in the 60s and the 70s, much more of one. So the ratio of underground versus popular albums is about, well, it's not, let's put it this way. The last album that we played for the alternative top 40 was number 79 in our selection. So here we are up to number 91. It's a little bit of a disparity, but not so bad. This, though, in April, from April 1970, the number one album that we are going to cover is the first post-Beatles solo album by Paul McCartney. Nothing indicated the end of the Beatles quite as bluntly as the release of this album, simply entitled McCartney. Perhaps for that very reason, I hated this album when it came out. I really did. But that wasn't the only reason I hated it. Keep in mind that in 1970, the last music that I had ever heard from Paul McCartney was Abbey Road, one of the most incredibly perfectly produced albums of all time. It was like pristine in its perfection. Now, on its heels, we hear about the Beatles' breakup suddenly. And then, very soon after that announcement comes out, Paul releases this collection of what I would have considered then to be half-baked casual slop.
Ouch.
It was stunning when this record came out, mostly for what it wasn't, meaning good. I mean, how could Paul, a Beatle, maybe the Beatle most responsible for that band's quality control, release this crap? I mean, at the time, I felt that there was only one song on the entire album that I would even imagine on a Beatles record. And that was the song that got airplay called Maybe I'm Amazed. It wasn't a hit single, just an album track that they would play. As for the rest of the album, it really only served as a dismal, depressing reminder that the dream is over, to quote John Lennon. How ironic is it then that now, almost 50 years later, I look back on this album. In fact, I look back on McCartney's entire solo career, 48 years worth of a solo career, and I find that this album, in my opinion, is in his top five all-time best. How sad is that? The album that I like right off as being a total piece of junk when it came out, now I look at his entire career and I'm like, you know, that's probably one of his best albums.
Well, it just doesn't speak very well of the rest of his albums.
It really doesn't. It really doesn't. I mean, so the ones that I would say that are up there, maybe ahead of it, Band on the Run, the album that came after this one, whose name is Ram, and Tug of War for three. Maybe there's a fifth there, so fourth there somewhere that might surpass this, but probably not. So heard from today's perspective, away from all the emotional weight brought on by the band's bitter breakup, This album does have a charm all of its own. I'm finally able to hear that through the nightmarish, you know, horror of the Beatles breaking up, and then hearing like McCartney seem to have something like a breakdown on this record. So this does rate as one of the more important and interesting solo albums from any Beatle. So here it is. The album McCartney, the cover. The only thing you see, no words, no nothing, just a white bench with a bowl with some cherry juice in it, and cherries look like they got taken out of the bowl and just thrown all over the table, as if to say, life was once a bowl of cherries.
Now it's the pits.
Now it is not, at least, right? That seems to be what it's saying. Now, the album came out because, you know, McCartney had, the Beatles were trying to get him to delay the release of this album because nobody had announced that the Beatles broke up yet. And so McCartney, just really to stave off the depression that he was beginning to feel. I mean, as far as in his entire life, he had one job. He was a Beatle. That's what he was his whole life. And now John says, I want a divorce.
Oops.
That's what he called it when he went into a meeting. And it sent McCartney like spinning. He just couldn't believe it. What else was he going to do with his life? He'd been a Beatle since he was 17, 16. And now what? So he basically, you know, started recording just to distract himself from what was happening. And he had worked out. I mean, the Beatles had Apple. So he said he wanted to release this album. And it was originally agreed that it would be okay. But then they got word that Spector had finished work on the Let It Be album. And that they wanted to release that as soon as possible so that it would coincide with the release of the film. Because the film was coming out. Now, that makes perfectly good sense. But McCartney saw it as though it was a power play against him, because the three Beatles had already begun to more or less move in circles completely away from Paul. The three Beatles were signing with a different management, and Paul wanted nothing to do with that management. He wanted to use his wife Linda's family as management. And so the three Beatles against him, it was basically the Eastmans versus Alan Klein is what it was. And the three Beatles all backed Alan Klein. Turned out that was probably the stupidest thing that the Beatles could have done, because Alan Klein was not walking off of their best interest.
No.
And I would say that Paul is probably right to say that his in-laws would have. But the Beatles didn't trust that because they figured the in-laws are going to look out for Paul's benefits first, not theirs. And, you know, Paul's first and theirs second. So you understand what caused the difference there. But now with the three Beatles on one side, they sent Ringo to Paul's house to basically ask him to deliver the news about what was happening and about how the album should be delayed for a few weeks to make way for Let It Be. So Ringo said that he would go talk to McCartney in person rather than have them basically send it by a messenger, really to be a nice guy.
Sure.
And Ringo said basically that Paul went crazy and threatened him, saying, I will finish you now. You'll pay for this.
Wow.
Yeah. McCartney said himself, he says that, you know, that basically, you know, he just figured that Ringo's star was basically, I want you to, his message to Paul was, you need to toe the party line. And Paul said, I told him to just get out. I had to do it because he felt that he was sinking. Paul just was like, basically felt like he was getting kicked in the head by all the other Beatles. And in the meantime, he's working on this album, and it's the exact opposite of what the Beatles were about. He wanted to stay away from George Martin. He didn't want to go to Abbey Road to do all the production. He just got a little four-track machine in his house, and he started fooling around with it, messing around with some ideas for tracks. It was really like the way that any one of us putting out an indie record or a solo record or learning to record for yourself would go about it at home. You'd get the machine, you'd put down a couple of tracks, you'd probably giggle about it a little bit when you hear yourself back the first time, and then you'd say, well, that wasn't so bad, because you're not going to be your worst critic. But what Paul did is he didn't even go back to even like play with it. This album opens with a track of the very first thing that Paul put down when he got his recorder. He got the machine, brings it into his house, he sets it up, this Studer recording, and he basically sits down and he had his little ditty of about a little bit more than a half a minute long, a song that he wrote about his wife, Linda, and he recorded it. And you even hear him like a little giggle at the end. And he puts it on the album. It's the leadoff track on the record. You can't help but think like, oh my God.
He's off his rocker.
Oh my God, what is he thinking? So at the time, it was a nightmare, especially since it more or less indicated like, here's Paul basically saying, I quit the Beatles so I could do this.
Mm-hmm.
So he became persona non grata. The world sort of like began to like really, Paul, like everybody was like down on Paul. But not to the point where they didn't want to buy the record because everybody was curious to hear this horrible album that was released by the Beatle. It's just so funny that it took years, maybe decades, for people to come around and just hear it as a quaint little record. And now I have to admit, you know, it's on my list for a reason. There's things about this record that I find utterly charming that at the time I found really, really disturbing. And I think the first two tracks will point out exactly what I'm talking about when I say that. You'll hear the lovely Linda, all 40-some-odd seconds of it, and they'll let that go into the second track that McCartney recorded on that tape machine called That Would Be Something.
La, 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 lovely Linda.
Imagine you're a Beatles fan. You know, you're been a Beatles fan since January of 1964 when they became huge here in America. You went through the whole phase of the 60s with the Beatles, all the incredible changes, watching the band get better and better and better, and just seemed like it was never going to stop. And the last thing that they put out that it was Abbey Road, and you knew it was that the band was in a weird place, but you didn't think that there was any rumor of them breaking up when that came out. And McCartney has songs like You Never Give Me Your Money, She Came In Through the Bathroom Window. That whole medley on side two of Abbey Road was just an amazing piece of work. And then this comes out and you hear those two tracks.
And you wonder if John Lennon was really writing at all.
You're probably right. You think like, whoa, I mean, I just thought, really, you know, I thought that, like that last song, that would be something, isn't really even a song. It's just barely like a fleshed out idea of a song.
Right.
It doesn't do anything, go anywhere. It's got mouth percussion and the drums sound ridiculous and it's redundant. It turns out, I mean, really, you got to hear it now as I can now hear it from McCartney's perspective. After Lennon made that announcement that he wants a, quote, divorce, Paul basically withdrew from the other Beatles and went into a real deep state of despondency. And he had a house, and he just married Linda, and Linda had a daughter, and they had recently had a second daughter together. And so it's a family, and Paul is now depressed out of his mind, drinking too much, and literally hiding out in a place called Campbelltown, Scotland. And nobody can find him. He's just there for month after month after month. As he was saying, he was basically described, his own words are, I nearly had a breakdown. I suppose the hurt of it all and the disappointment and the sorrow of losing this great band, these great friends, I was going crazy. So it was just really bad. Now, to think about this now at the same time, Paul's hiding out in Scotland, depressed, not really, nobody's seeing him. The band doesn't see him. So this exacerbates the whole problem with the management thing, because the three Beatles decided to go with Klein, and Paul's hiding out. He's not showing up to make any decisions. He's not contributing to anything because he's withdrawn. It just makes the split between him and the other three Beatles that much worse. And now it feels like a real divorce, and it's getting uglier by the minute because Paul's too depressed to interact in a positive way. And on top of this now, because he's withdrawn, all those rumors about Paul is dead go insane, especially in America. Now it's like, oh, the guy's definitely dead. He's, you know, he's gone. Nobody can find him. You know, it really began to get totally out of control. And it was like at this point in time that, you know, basically he says that, you know, this period in time was really grim for Linda. She had a 7-year-old and a baby to look after with a husband who was depressed and drunk. She did tell friends that it was one of the most difficult times in her life. While Paul basically said that he really thinks that he might have become a rock and roll casualty at this point in his career. But it was Linda who encouraged him to begin considering the idea of a future outside of the Beatles, maybe writing or finishing some of his own songs for a personal collection, an album. He didn't even think of the fact that he could make an album. Imagine that. This is Paul McCartney of the Beatles. So he basically does. He gets this machine, a Studer 4-track. Didn't even have meters. So he was having, you know, it was hard for him to mix because he could put on only one instrument at a time. He does everything on the record, every noise. I'm not saying that's a magical, incredible feat, because when you hear it, it's pretty stark.
Yes, it's very basic.
Yeah, really basic. But this is him basically putting down a track, saying, okay, I'm going to put a bass down underneath that. Oh, I can play drums. I'll record a basic drum part, put that down, and then I'll put down a vocal. When he even did that, a lot of the times he'd have the idea and he didn't even bother to write words. This is, again, so weird for Paul McCartney. But for him, it was just an exercise. Please let me find my sanity again. I need to find my center, my happiness. So he put down Lovely Linda, he recorded That Would Be Something, and the third song that he taped while he was in Scotland, hiding out from everybody, is this song called Valentine Day. Like I said, one of those songs he didn't even bother to write words for. ¶¶ Yeah, 1970, if you were hearing this album for the first time, it was at this point that you knew you were really had good reason to be afraid. Because here is like one of the most respected musicians who never really, he was infallible. And you're hearing like these songs and you're like, this is a nightmare. This can't be happening. This is so frightening. But after Paul got the idea into his head that he really was going to make a record and the therapy was more or less working and he was beginning to feel good about it, he realized that maybe he could start concentrating on a theme about the thing that would make him happy, that he's got a new life with a new wife and a family. And he decided to bring Linda in and maybe he'd use her on harmony for some things.
He said,
but it did actually help in that sense because he was not totally alone. She was at least beginning to provide him with some input. She was the only one. This is the other big problem, you see. And no offense to Linda, but he's so isolated that he's doing all of this music. And when he was in the Beatles, he'd have thousands of people hearing it and giving him their opinions on what they would do and producers coming up with ideas and arrangements and things to make everything perfect. Now he's got nobody, not a soul to talk to about it. It's just him in a room by himself doing stuff. And there's nobody to give him feedback except Linda when she hears it, who wants to support him because she's worried about him because he's depressed. So he'll probably play a song like Valentine's Day, what we just heard. And she'd go like, great, good, yeah, wow.
Awesome.
Oh, you're good, Paul. You're going to be a good songwriter one day. But finally, he gets his act together, at least enough mentally, and he decides that he's going to go to Abbey Road to record some of the album. And there were bits that he had left over that but just before the Beatles broke up, there were songs that they were considering recording. In fact, during that Get Back sessions, there are segments where you hear Paul showing the band certain songs. One of them is this song called Every Night. And the Beatles never got around to recording it, but they were learning the song. And it ended up getting put to the side. So Paul says, okay, if the Beatles aren't going to use it, I'll record it. I'll go to Abbey Road. I'll do that myself. So here's the first song on the album that actually gets a bit of professionalism to the way that it's recorded and presented. And it's like suddenly like this ray of hope in the middle of these, like you heard, that weird, almost frightening introduction to the album. This song pops up called Every Night on 90.3 WHPC.
Every night I just want to go out, get out of my head. Every day I don't want to get up, get out of my bed. Every night I want to play out, and every day I want to do. But tonight I just want to stay in and be with you. And be with you.
Yeah, I'm back to total weirdness there again.
He was trying to do those weird segues that the fancy producers do, not so successfully.
Not so slick. I mean, the song that we heard every night, fine, good. I mean, if the album was of that caliber, nobody would have like really freaked out, I think. They would have said, okay, good, he's on his own. Look, he's producing it himself. You know, this is, or, you know, he's in the studio and he's not working with George Martin, but he's got coming up with good material. Like every night could have been a Beatles track. But these other things, you wouldn't even dream of this stuff being anywhere near a Beatles album. So it just was like kind of just, I don't know. I mean, what the track that we just heard after Every Night was called Hot as Sun, segueing into Glasses, which is to say Hot as Sun is the instrumental. He recorded that at a place called Morgan Studios. That was the first place that he went when he left Scotland. There was a place in the suburbs of London, Willesden Green. That makes me think of the Kinks. There was a place called Morgan Studios, and he booked it as Billy Martin so that nobody would bother him. And he went in, and that's where he recorded the Hot as Sun segment, that instrumental. And again, it's okay. It's not a complete musical thought, no lyrics, and just a very short section. Was it a 90-second bit? And then that fades out, and it comes into the Glasses section. Now, Glasses is literally McCartney licking his finger and playing the top of wine glasses and recording them one on top of another for about 30 seconds. That's all it is. Just the same way, you know, it's really like the world's interested in hearing you do that. And then it suddenly, almost joltingly, goes into that weird piano bit.
He should have gotten your son to do that, because at least your son can actually play music on Rings of Glasses.
Yeah, he can actually arrange it. Yeah, like a good piano player could. You like arrange them in pitch and you play something, right?
Well, Paul's a piano player.
Yeah. I mean, he just basically decided to just go for the noise. But that weird piano bit at the end of that is a song called Suicide that he didn't bother to put on the album in its entirety. When it was subsequently re-released, that track was added. And it's just as worthless as the rest of it. It's a song that goes nowhere. It just bounces around and it's weird. So, in fact, just hearing the 10 seconds that you hear there is plenty, I think. For me, it was more than enough.
You got the flavor of it.
Exactly. Now, the one song on the record, though, that really sunk in for me, honestly, on side one anyway, was this next song. I think it was one of the prettier things that McCartney had ever written. And I definitely could imagine this being on a subsequent Beatles album, especially if you could imagine John's harmony and if they were going and basically adding just a little bit of an edge to it. But it's a very beautiful song, like I said. So this was almost enough of the time to save side one then. And now it's enough for me to say this album's a really interesting record to hear now. You know, from 48 years perspective, you go back and you listen to this, you're like, wow, it's a strange listen, but it's a fun listen. The song I'm talking about is called simply Junk on 90.3 WHPC.
Motor cars, handlebars, bicycles for two, broken hearted jubilee. Parachutes, army boots, sleeping bags for two, sentimental jamboree. In the yard.
thought were mine alone. Now let me lie with my love for the time I am home.
Tracks that falls into the music hall tradition of Paul's songwriting, which he does an awful lot of, that fits there. It was also the last song recorded for the album, added really just before it got released. It was only maybe about a month and a half before the album was completed and actually released when that song was recorded. That's the end of side one of the album, McCartney. Paul's first solo album, which was so dismally depressing in its own time, and now it kind of shines as this little weird little beacon of like original strangeness. Like it's an area where he just doesn't really go that often, unfortunately. I mean, back then you got to, you know, think about this. I mean, to take this into consideration and to be fair about it, don't remember the albums that John Lennon was releasing solo while the Beatles were together? He was releasing Two Virgins with him and Yoko naked on the cover, and it's just a sound of them basically screaming each other's name into a cassette recorder. It was like, you know, then Unfinished Music, Life with the Lions, which had a basically a recording of Yoko's pregnant baby's heartbeat, and then it stops when the baby, you know, because the baby is a miscarriage. And it's just like really weird. This John's releasing this stuff. It's just like, it was like that was like nightmarishly bad in comparison. This album was the life of the party. So keep things in perspective. All right, let's flip over the record. Here are a couple more weird ones, a couple more casual toss-offs as side two begins. The first track we're going to hear is called simply Ooh You on 90.3 WHPC.
Guitar. Ooh.
Himself.
Followed by, we just heard exactly, Mama Miss America. A bit of the problem, yeah, playing with himself indeed. The first tracks on side two, you start thinking like, okay, this is only marginally better than the other side. I'm not even sure if it is. But then this song came up. This is another one of those songs that they were fooling around with at the Beatles. If you think about the stuff that was recorded around Abbey Road, the reason that whole segue happened on side two was because both Paul and John had a whole bunch of songs that they didn't finish. Just snippets, and they usually bring them to each other, and one would write the middle eight for the other, and that's how they'd end up with songs. But they weren't doing that anymore, and they ended up, each of them had these little bits of songs, so Paul strung them all together into that awesome segue, and that made them into something glorious. But in this instance, you know, Paul again had a snippet of a song called Teddy Boy that he would just go around and around forever and ever with the Beatles. It was like enough. It would drive anybody nuts. So he'd just do it for like 8 minutes playing the same thing. And then he ends up putting it out on this album. What does he do? It's the same thing. It's just that same round. He didn't add anything to it. It just gets redundant. It's called Teddy Boy, 90.3 WHPC.
This is the story of a boy named Ted. If his mother said Ted be good, he would. She told him tales about his soldier dad, but it made her sad, and she cried, oh my. Ted used to tell her he'd be twice as good, and he knew he could, 'cause in his head he said, "Mama, don't worry, no Teddy Boy's here, taking good care of you. Mama, don't worry, your Teddy Boy's here, Teddy's gonna see you through." Then came the day she found herself a man. Teddy turned and ran far away. Couldn't stand to see his mother in love with another man he didn't know, oh no. He found a place where he could settle down, and from time to time in his head he said, "Mommy, don't worry, no Teddy Boy's here, taking good care of you. Mommy, don't worry, your Teddy Boy's here, Teddy's gonna see you through." She said, "Teddy, don't worry, now mommy is here, taking good care of you. Teddy, don't worry, your mommy is here, mommy's gonna see you through." This is the story of a boy named Ted. If his mother said Ted be good, he would.
Background after Teddy Boy is a track called Sing Along Junk, which is the instrumental version of the beautiful song we heard on side one. And it's a beautiful instrumental version as well. I'm talking over it now because I want to try to get in the remaining two tracks before the show is over. First up next is the single song that justifies the entire album's existence. Still one of the best songs McCartney recorded in his entire solo career, called Maybe I'm Amazed. Never released as a single. If you wanted it, you'd have to buy this album until a live version came out with Wings. That is followed by a song that McCartney had written about Amazonian Indians. What he saw of a documentary about them on the hunt. So he basically wrote a song about basically saying, what would it sound like musically to accompany them if I was watching these Indians on the hunt? They were called the Crean Na Crore. So that's what he names the song, Crean Na Crore. So here we are then with Crean Na Crore, but preceded by Maybe I'm Amazed on 90.3 WHPC. Thank you, everybody. See you on Friday.